Tonight, it's my great pleasure to welcome Joseph W. Ulmer, author of Universitas, Toward an Awakened Future, to the store. He's a resident, Sebastopol resident for 33 years, a lifelong teacher, and veterans of the men's consciousness movement of the 80s, a lifelong student of biology and anthropology, and we are looking forward to hearing about his understanding of mind and consciousness. Thank you so much for joining us.
Having been a teacher for so long, this looks familiar. Nobody wants to sit in the front row.
I will.
There's always one. A little bit about myself, so you know where I'm coming from. I was raised and schooled in the sciences, and so it took me a long time to write this book, and not so much to write it, but to feel that somehow a scientist could invade this realm of consciousness and talk about consciousness, something that was not provable mathematically, and we'll talk about more of that later. So it did take a long time, and I at this point I'd like to acknowledge my beholding, my beholdenness to the Institute of Noetic Sciences, IONS, because it was my association with them for a period of time that showed me that intuition may be a valid and worthwhile introduction to what we would like to call as truth. And everything isn't scientific in the sense that if it can't be proven mathematically, then it's not true. I learned early on in my life, from periods when I was avoiding my father, and I would hide out in the woods, that all answers, or my personal feeling was that answers were available to us in nature. And so in this book I've tried to hold true to that and to follow the evolution of thought and physicality in a logical way, and see if we couldn't find some true answers in nature. So in a sense, it took me a long time to tell myself it's okay to go ahead and finish this book. And I'd like to wander for a moment through the broad outlines of the book. And first of all, I'd like to start with a disclaimer, which in the book is the epilogue. So in a kind of rare occurrence, I'll start with the epilogue, in which I point out that nothing's new. Shortly after I finished this text, I started to read another book, and I forget what it was called. The Jesus Chronicles or something like that, I forget exactly, but it was talking about all the ancient thoughts on the subject of consciousness, and it turned out that this idea that consciousness is outside of the box, outside the box, has been around for a long time, and that there was various times, and I guess we'll get to that with Descartes, that things really went downhill as far as intuition and non-provable thought. Just for instance, a writing by Thomas Berry, one of my favorite authors. He said, any creative deed at the human level is a continuation of the creativity of the universe. The continuation of the creativity of the universe. So everything is connected. Also in the epilogue, the Gnostics believe that the higher self is actually the one soul of the universe, the consciousness that inhabits each of us. So consciousness inhabits. We don't generate it. Okay, and again, I'm jumping ahead, but this is the kind of idea that I would like to promote and to come to the realization of. There are certain premises that underlie the book, the first of which, and before I go on to that, I'd like to say that having been a teacher, I'm an advocate of the Socratic dialogue. So if there's anything that I say, I beg you to raise your hand or sing out or say whatever you care to say. And ask at the moment. Don't let us go on and have things not understood. Also, in having been a teacher, I realize that most people are not comfortable doing that, but do your best. Premises that underlie the book. First of all, I believe in Darwinian evolution. And again, if you can't accept that for some reason or other, then a lot of the things that I say are not going to follow in a logical way. Number two is, of time, there is enough. There's enough time for all these things to happen. My favorite saying about time is the... And again, I don't know where I read it from, but there was a, it says that there is a block of granite, far in the north there's a block of granite, and the granite is 100 miles high and 100 miles wide and 100 miles deep, and every 1,000 years a bird comes and sharpens its beak on that block of granite, and when it's thus worn away, one day in eternity has passed. And again, if we can get our minds around this, we begin to understand that there is enough of time and for everything to happen. So that if something's possible, then it becomes probable in the immensity of time. Another premise is that there was a Cartesian split in the early 1700s, and the Cartesian split was, as some of you may know, the scientist Descartes was actually protecting himself. He was smart enough to recognize Galileo, Giordano Bruno, Copernicus, Kepler. All these men had been vilified by the church because they had not proscribed, or they were advocating things that were not within the venue or not within the belief system of the church. And Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake. Galileo was put into house arrest for, I don't know, 20 years or something like that. Copernicus, who was not the originator of, but who wrote a treatise on the heliocentric, the sun-centered solar system, did not have his book published until he was dead, because he knew what was going to happen. And to bring us further on, in 1859, Darwin was famously reluctant to publish his book, The Origin of Species, because he knew what the Victorian mindset was, that the church was very strong and that they would be against it. So it wasn't until he was forced to promote, to publish by the intuitive coming to natural selection by Wallace that that he had to publish or else get preempted by Wallace. So that there was a split. Descartes decided or kind of made a pact with the church. I will not deal with anything in science that has to do with the spirit, with consciousness, with anything that can't be proven. I will deal strictly with material things, things that we can touch. And thus, this split in the between the church and science happened, and that happened in the 1600s. And it so happens that, and here's a diagram of way I represent this, and that is that previous to that time, all these lineages of what was called natural philosophy, mathematics, and astronomy, and astrology, and theories of various kinds, were all together, and they're all working together. But then at this time of this split, of Descartes saying, don't burn me at the stake, these all split. And he wrote, this is where the separation took place. And so all these lineages started to diverge, and it's shown as a sphere here. I don't know how many there are, but anyway, I think in my reading that I can see that these lineages are starting to come together. And I've drawn a line here saying today, hopefully, and what I'm seeing is that a lot of these ideas in ions, for instance, and many other disciplines in the advancement of Buddhist thought, for instance, Eastern thought, bringing a lot of the ideas together, and I think that at some point in the future, these lineages are going to reunite. At least that's my hope. Premises.
Can you give some examples of why you think these different lines are coming together?
Well, yeah, I think just the idea that there's so many books like Christian de Quincey's Radical Nature and writers like Loren Isley, who's a scientist who's gotten the Nobel Prize in literature, Chris Bache, writing again through ions, author of Dark Night and Early Dawn. Just a few things off the top of my head. I perhaps some of you have other ideas, but certainly. Teilhard de Chardin, for instance, is an anthropologist, but also a priest, and he was censured within the church, but he carried on, and so these ideas, and his idea of the noosphere, for instance, that there is a consciousness sphere, is essentially what he's talking about. Is part of that. I mean, I think there's a lot of integrated thinking that's going on. Let's see.
Joe?
Yeah.
Would you say that the modern phenomena of the emergence of religion as a big overt force in politics is one of those things that's mixing it up?
No. Personally, I see that as being more reactionary rather than than unifying.
I guess what I'm thinking is that they're capitalizing, regardless of the motivation, whatever, they're capitalizing on a feeling amongst people that there is more than just reductionistic truth available. There are things that are true. And I think people are, I'm agreeing with you basically, people are hungering for more of a connection between what we've been told in childhood was on the one hand, and the other hand, they're really not so separate.
I agree with that, but I don't see that in the kinds of Beckian and Limbaughian dialogue that is coming out. I see that as a...
I don't use those words in public.
I think people are seeking this, but they're seeking it outside of dogma and outside yes. of theology. So I don't think that movement will be successful insofar as it tries to impose some sort of dogma or theology.
Oh, I'm not Good. Suggesting it's an end. I'm saying it's a symptom of a willingness of people at large to consider more things. And
I think what you're saying is closer to what Carl is implying, and that is that there is a resurging interest in religion in a maybe a small R context, not an institutionalized context. And what I gather is that a lot of what you're talking about is institutional thinking, you know, and I think that's part of the Cartesian split that I like to talk about, you know, is that oh, that belongs to the church, you know, you can't do that, you know. Whereas I think more and more people are unifying their thoughts and saying that, as I hope I have, actually, in the sense that I've accepted intuition, and I've accepted dreams, and I've accepted things as valid to rational thought. I don't know if I'm saying that exactly how I mean it, but in other words, it's a valid way to learn truth. That's the thing. I mentioned that I believe that in nature one finds answers. Intuition is acceptable. I believe also in the biological theory that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. I'm sure some of you have heard that in or remember it from your biology class, but essentially that the development of the individual from conception on follows or goes through the stages of the development of the species, so that we go through a period, for instance, in the mother's womb, where we have a tail, where we have gills, where our limbs look like paddles, you know, and on and on. And it isn't until about 3 months on that we can be told from a pig, you know, or a buffalo, you know. So I also believe in the corollary to that, and that is that after birth, that the development of the individual recapitulates the social development that the social cultural history that we've gone through. And so there's, first of all, as a babe, we are totally dependent on the group. And then we see ourselves as somehow separate from the group, and hopefully, eventually, we get to the point where we think, oh, the group is important to me, and I'm going to help the group, okay? Not because I have to, but because I'm an aware individual, and I can do it as an individual because I know it's the right thing, and I know that the group is what I belong to. You know, and again, in a genetic sense, the group is where my gene pool is, and so I better protect it if I want that to go on. And we'll get to that further too. Finally, the final premise is that knowing parts does not help us to know the whole. Okay, and unfortunately for me, science has gone in that direction of looking for smaller and smaller and smaller parts. So the atom, for instance, are looking for what's the name of the last gluon or whatever it is, the last particle that makes up an atom. They used to think that the atom was the last indivisible aspect of matter, that each type of matter had its own atom, and that was it. But now we know that you can split it up, and now we know there's electrons and protons, and then we know that the protons are made up of and neutrons are made up of other kinds of particles, and they're looking in these massive cyclotrons, they're looking for the last little thing that makes up this they call it the God particle.
Higgs boson.
The what?
Higgs boson.
That's it. Kids boson. That's it. Thank you. However, my analogy is that you don't study clay that the bricks are made of to learn architecture. You know, to me, it's the whole that's important. You know, and there's many examples of that. I remember. Oh, it must have been 20 years ago. Do you remember the biosphere, for instance? They were thinking we can create these little enclaves, and we can transplant them to the moon, and we can have colonies on the moon. So they made what they thought was an Earth-like environment, and they enclosed it in a bubble, and they put people in there to live, recycle water, you know, have stuff grow, sunlight came in, all these kinds of things. And in a matter of I don't think it was much more than a month or two, that the whole thing broke down, because we had no conception of what an environment, what an ecosystem was. And we still don't. We can talk about them, we can talk about ecosystems, but we don't know what they are. So we can study the parts, and we know basically what photosynthesis is, and we know how water translates through the ground, and roots can take it up and everything, but we don't understand the totality, everything that's needed, the mycorrhiza, the fungi that are necessary for the roots to take up water and minerals, and how the minerals get there and break down, everything that we think about a tree, and in thinking about a tree, our mind should include the water and the transpiration and the relationship between the groundwater and the clouds above the tree, that the trees have transpired. The minerals that are being broken down and used by the tree to build material, and on and on and on. We could go on forever on that. But again, the premise of the book is that the whole is what's important. It's the parts are interesting perhaps to a particle physicist, but it's the whole that works. Okay, there are two goals in the book. One is to seek to recover or reconvey the subject of consciousness back to nature, and to begin to reverse what I've called the Cartesian split. And secondly, I would like to develop the idea that consciousness, which we finally get to in the final chapter, is a logical expectation of evolution. And the book title, I think, is important here. The term universitas I got from Richard Tarnas in The Passion of the Western Mind, and his used the term universitas, and I remember reading that, and I said, ah, that's it. And I was looking for a title. Universitas means to signify the concrete universe as a single, homogeneous ensemble, a divine harmony of natural diversity. And so that's what I hope is implied in the title. So that's how I got the title anyway. Finally, the last disclaimer that I want to make, perhaps, is that if it's Lamarckian, it isn't. If it sounds Lamarckian, it isn't. Now again, from your biology, you may remember that Lamarck preceded Darwin. There are many evolutionists before Darwin. Lamarck, one of the most famous and well-known. But his idea was that yes, indeed, species change. Okay, that things did evolve. But his idea was that it evolved by passing on acquired characteristics. So a giraffe got its long neck because it stretched its neck out to get higher up, be more successful, to get more food, and pass this longer neck on to the to its offspring, and then it apparently reached up higher and stretched its neck out and passed a longer neck on. The idea that if you cut rats' tails off, then their offspring will have short tails, which of course is not the case, and we know that now. But Lamarck talked about the passing on of acquired characteristics, and he talked about need. In other words, that they needed to change, and so consequently they did. Okay, and now of course we know that individuals don't change; it's only species that do. Individuals have small corrections or small changes in their genetic information, but they pass these on, and they're either successful or they're not. They either are acceptable to natural selection or they're not. And so we no longer accept the ideas of Lamarck, but some of the things I say in the book sound Lamarckian. In other words, I talk about trends, for instance. I talk about something needs to be, but and so if it, as I say, if it sounds Lamarckian, if it sounds like it's not purely evolutionary dogma, that's a bad word to use, but if it doesn't fit your concept of Darwin, it really is, and it's not Lamarckian. So I just want you to understand that. Okay, there are many things we don't know. Okay, and I think it's really important to know this, to accept this first, and that is that if we if you read anything, and they talk about the beginning. Okay, if they talk about what happened at the beginning, at the time, this moment of the Big Bang, and they talk like they know what's happened. They don't. They're lying. Okay. Oh, I want you to know that there's nothing that we know yet. There's nothing that we can conceive of to make zero equals one, and that's exactly what the Big Bang is asking us to do. So I'm a banger. You know, I study geology, and I understand that not that kind of banger. I believe it. I accept it as the most valid current attempt to explain the origin of the universe. But I can't conceive of it. I can't conceive of nothing becoming something. I can't conceive of there being nothing and then being everything. And
this, what just the thought that you used, that is the arrogance of the conceptual mind wanting to conceive that which is beyond conceiving.
Exactly.
Okay.
So although I would like to, it would be.
But it's not experiential. It's true.
Where we are now, right.
Pure experience, I think, is beyond. Beyond conceit. You cannot bring it into words.
Yeah. I agree. I agree at this point. I'm thinking that, in the great hope that Desjardins was right, and that we will get to a point of a noosphere, there is a point that we will be God. But it's still inconceivable. I agree with you. It's totally inconceivable.
It's where we don't stand in the way of God being us is a little different from saying being God, because again it's coming from the conceptual side, isn't it? From the non-conceptual side, and so there's still that flavor of arrogance involved.
Well, I'm quite sure that I carry some of the arrogance of the scientist. But I'm doing my best. Okay. let's see. Anyone. No one knows. In other words, despite what they would say, that they understand this or they understand that, they don't. I can guarantee it. But I would like to lead us along the path of probable development. I'm sure that life is a statistical improbability. Is not a statistical improbability, that it is in fact a probable, and also inherent in this, and I hope that somewhere along the line you accept that this, that the final idea in the book is or fits into the realm of being an elegant theory, and by an elegant theory I mean one. Einstein talked about it, and many people have, that it's a theory that explains things better. It explains more things in a more coherent way. Okay, the best example I can give of an elegant theory is seafloor spreading, for instance. Again, I mentioned I was in geology. I was in geology in the United States when they believed that the continents and the oceans were where they always have been, and there was no concept that they couldn't move. There were in Europe and South America, there were geologists who thought the continents had moved. They looked at the concordance between the coastlines of South America and Africa. Look at this; they would fit in there, There are all examples of a German paleobotanist by the name of Wegener studied plant fossils in India and in Africa, and he said, "Wow, they're similar. They're almost the same, And how did we explain that? We explained it well when they needed to go be the same, a land bridge rose up out of the ocean, and the plants migrated along there, and consequently, then the land bridge went down and left these colonies of plants. So it was if you needed something, you just rose it up, something happened and you let it drop down again. But this didn't explain, for instance, of the evidence of glaciers coming up out of the ocean in South America, for instance, you know, which were at the same time as glaciers in Africa coming east. So there were a lot of things. And this didn't change until 1959 in the International Geophysical Year, when everybody agreed to share their information from deep ocean exploration, and there was so much evidence that supported the idea of continental drift that American geologists, which were the most recalcitrant, could no longer deny that it existed. And I'd like to talk about that more, but my time is running out. We accept the idea of the red shift, the Doppler effect. You've all heard a train go by and it goes ding 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 when it goes by, right? Well, light does the same thing. As we know that the universe is expanding because the things that are furthest away from us are, and therefore retreating the fastest, are the light is shifted more to the red end of the spectrum. In other words, their speed away is being subtracted from the speed of light, and so the light tends to look a little redder. Okay, my idea is that we could, if you could expand that, we have no idea how much of the universe we know. So if you expand that and say that there are things that are moving even faster away from us, why couldn't that shift be a radio shift, for instance? Right? In other words, why couldn't the electromagnetic spectrum be shifted even further than the red? I try to show in the book that life is just part of a continuum. You know, we can, again, if you start with the Big Bang and you start with the smallest Higgs gluon, boson.
Higgs
boson. And you can, once you have that, you can envision things evolving, getting larger, getting together from to atoms, to molecules, to larger molecules, to molecules that all of a sudden have carbon attached to them. So we have a whole new chemistry of organic chemistry. And there are many, I talked a long time about the work to show that given the elements of a primordial ocean and atmosphere, you can with the influx of energy give rise to amino acids and the beginning forms of life. Talk about evolution. Nature is totally impartial. A lot of people think that individuals change. In other words, that the individual is important, and that's in our country. That's become very, very entrenched. The idea of the importance of the individual, but in nature, the individual is for nothing. I write in a book that nature cares for species. In other words, it's species that evolve by the micro changes in the individuals within that species. But now I believe, in thinking more about it, I really believe that nature simply cares for life. Nature cares to prolong and promote life. I have a number of pages about genetic engineering, who has the right, for instance, to take species that have no relationship to each other and join them? There's an artist back east who took jellyfish DNA and put it in a rabbit, so the rabbit glowed like a jellyfish. You know, what? Where does individual rights take us? You know? There are generalizations about life. It's a continuum of molecular evolution. Given enough time, anything is possible, is probable. Life is a threshold in this continuum. In other words, at some point in organic evolution, some complex molecule, whether it's a DNA or whether it's at the level of virus or whatever, passed this threshold of life. Okay, and I think we can show that threshold is just one point in a continuum. I remember, in studying geology, that when we studied the Cambrian period, the Cambrian was the mark of the sudden appearance of life. Okay, it wasn't a sudden appearance of life; it was a sudden appearance of things that gave fossils, and they had hard parts. Because since then, they've found, like in Australia and up in the Burgess Shale in Canada, very special kinds of environments where soft parts were discovered, were preserved. And so we know that life started way, way, way before the Cambrian period. The other thing to remember is that no species evolves alone. In other words, you and I are present because we have a certain kind of atmosphere, we have certain kinds of foods available, we have certain kinds of support systems, we can be understood in that context, not as an individual. Try to show at least that given life, intelligence is predictable. Okay, and how do I do that? You know, first of all, one of the characteristics of life is movement. Okay, if you have movement, then what's an advantage is being able to have directional movement. Okay, once you have directional movement, then you have the need to get those sensory organs into the front where you're going, because it's better to know where you're going than where you've been, and because by the time you learn where you've been, it might be too late. So given directionality, then we can accept headedness, concentration of sensory organs. These concentration of sensory organs lead to a brain that becomes an advantage by being more responsive, faster to discern, discriminating. Then, just as life is a threshold, intelligence is a threshold, whatever that means, where we get more of a reflective response, for instance. Once we have a brain and intelligence, then how do we advance that? How does that become an evolutionary process? And that becomes evolutionary by being able to communicate it. And so we have communication then becoming an evolutionary process. And so. Different kinds of communication occur. You know, you have dances, you have pheromones, you have various kinds of signals. But among some organisms, there's a vocal kind of communication. And in humans, that became more and more and more discriminatory in the sense that we could refine that. And it became an evolutionary advantage but it was also a dangerous one. What happened when the main thing is that our larynx was evolutionarily was dropped down so that there's more of a resonance, there's more of a weight. Our tongue is looser. It's not tied to the bottom of our palate, or the bottom of the mouth like in gorillas. But the problem was that when our jaw shortened, for instance, we no longer had the space for our teeth. So there were a lot of things. The dropped larynx increased the chance of choking, for instance. Okay, so there were a lot of things like this, but they were the advantages outweighed the disadvantages. And I think there's a lot of things in evolution we can show. Birds, for instance, flight is a disadvantage in the sense that the bird has to be very slight, the bones have to be very fragile and light, they're hollow more or less, so there are certain disadvantages, but the advantage of flight, this whole new niche that's opened up for them, is of such great advantage that they can get past those disadvantages. So a lot of times we're successful in spite of things that happen. Let's see. Okay, so if we can accept evolution of the mind, evolution of a more advanced brain like we like to think we have, there's two possibilities, there's two directions, two alternatives that we can have. One is the continued inflation of individual importance. In other words, we can go along the path we have, our obsession with technology, the importance of celebrities, for instance, these kind of things. Or we can go in the direction of the increased cohesion with other minds. And I think this is the this, of course, is the direction that I would like to show in the book. And I'm way too many notes here. I talk about trends in human evolution.
Professor?
Yeah.
You were going to get around to talking about how this is related to consciousness?
Yeah, okay, we'll do that. I talk about social evolution. In other words, we have individual evolution and we have social evolution. In other words, we've gone through and we've got a lot don't have time to go through that. Technical evolution. Yeah, essentially everything's gone too far. In technical evolution, one thing that I would like to bring out is that we've lost what I call human scale. And you can read about that in the book too. Okay, so where are we? Okay. Again, I want to say there's nothing new. Where do we go from here? Okay. Nothing new. Nor are your thoughts the thoughts of you alone. The sea of common thought does claim them as her own. That's from the book of Near Dad. Okay. Where is there toward which we must relentlessly aim? The intention here is that toward combined the direction we're going toward combined consciousness awareness of consciousness for its further evolution, toward limiting the use of independence on finite resources, we can go on. And toward the acceptance of individual responsibility for human progress within consciousness, the all-pervading universal consciousness. Okay, and the idea of universal consciousness is what I feel is the basic principle of the book, and that is that we do not, put it this way, the previous and most of the investigations and the work and the study done on consciousness is trying to figure out how the material brain, how brain matter can give rise to consciousness. And it's either looked on as a function of brain matter, of all the neurons, etc. Okay, or it's that it's given, that it's somehow through nature and nurture allowed us. Okay, this is the materialist and the idealist philosophies. What I'm saying in the book is that consciousness is like Desjardins' noosphere. That consciousness is a universal presence. And I use the analogy of a radio. Okay, I use a radio because I grew up with it in the Depression. Okay, radio waves exist. Radio waves are there. They've been there since the time, since the Big Bang. Okay, but it wasn't until we developed a method called a radio to receive them and to amplify them and to hear them. Okay, what I'm saying is that consciousness is the same thing, that the evolution of the brain, of the mind, has been toward awareness. It's not consciousness. It's awareness. We've evolved a mechanism called a brain that has the ability to receive consciousness. And everything that we think about, you know, I talked about an elegant theory, and if anything can be shown not to be a reception or any of the things that I say, for instance, let us examine what making big C, capital C, which is what I use for universal consciousness, our operant model allows us to understand. Mind is the milieu within which awareness of consciousness is manifest. It is not the generative source of consciousness, but as potentially dynamic and eager receiver. Yeah.
The thing is, a human, why would the universe wait 4.5 billion years for our brains to be aware of consciousness, even though there might be another planet source? But it's just, it almost makes you like, why did I have to wait so long? To make that radio.
Yeah, that's well stated.
It's a long time.
My only answer to that is that it took nature, the evolutionary process, a long time. For instance, life started in the water. Okay, it took a long time to evolve a process. A kidney, for instance, that could exist on land, so that an organism could exist on land and have a kidney that would pull back the water to allow it to stay on land and not have to return like amphibians to the water to keep moist. So it's a long process. It's been a long 15 billion year process of evolving to get to this point. that would be my answer to your question. It's just, you know, we're too complex to have started with. You know, we didn't start out with bones, for instance.
So now that we can tune in.
Right, now that we can tune in. The sense of an internal God, we talk about the God within, okay? What is that? But the pervasive presence of this universal consciousness. It's there. It's invading us. It's pervading our body at all times. We either sense that or we don't. We either sense it as conscience, for instance. We all have a conscience. We all have, oh, I shouldn't have done that. Okay, where does that come from? That's universal consciousness. It's saying, this is the way it should be, not that way. Okay. The universal belief that there's something beyond us, whatever you call it, a first source, a first ultimate truth, Wakantanka, whatever it is, God, there is some sense that there is something beyond us. Okay, it is beyond us, I talked about the noosphere of Desjardins. It's not coming. It's not going to be created by our minds joining together. It already exists, and it's our minds that are going to have to be aware of it. Okay. Accumulated wisdom is so important. Yes.
You said you work with the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Mm-hmm. What do you think about them as a platform for these ideas, for people like Rupert Sheldrake to be able to be published there? And
I think it's great. I think they wouldn't have published this because it. My feeling is, what I've grown to feel is that they were reluctant. They were trying to be scientific. There was a lot of the scientific work that they did on learning about consciousness and non-locality and things like this and transference of thoughts. They were trying to do them in scientific ways, you know, instead of. It exists, you know, it is. I don't have to prove it.
Let me see if I understand what you said. Evolution explains and grows awareness, but consciousness was always there. What we need is to learn to sense it, like developing a radio to receive radio transmissions. Is that an accurate statement?
Yeah.
Of your statement?
Yeah. Okay. Not sense it, but be aware of it. And I guess that'd be sense it. Yeah.
Don't you think we reach a state of readiness?
Pardon?
We reach a state of readiness when these things.
Radio.
You know, I think we've been ready. I think, as I said, there's, you know, I could read all these things in the epilogue. It's been said many, many times that we've been there, you know, and the people in, you know, De Quincey writes about. Consciousness all the way down, you know. He talks about consciousness, but you know, it's not consciousness, it's awareness of consciousness, you know. And the Buddhists, for instance, talk about consciousness sleeps in rocks, it stirs in plants, and what's the term? And it becomes aware in man, in other words, I think they have a much more realistic view of consciousness.
So, what's it going to take for science to develop a radio?
This kind of radio. I don't think science. I don't think science.
I agree, but
science won't.
Science won't.
No, I don't. Science is too tied to the Cartesian idea that you've got to be able to prove it and do it mathematically and have all these kinds of proofs and
so it has very
so it's you and I have to do it.
But then, if I understand right, science has very little to do with this discussion. If that's true, that science has no capacity for developing those kind of that kind of sensing of consciousness, then it has no real point. There's no point in talking about science unless it has something to contribute to the sensing of consciousness. Is that accurate?
You said it, Robin.
Well, I'm asking you, but it's a question.
Yes, and, you know, as a scientist, I agree with you. Science has nothing to say about that, because they won't. Because,
well, aside with whether they will or they won't, yeah. I mean, let's imagine 30 years from now. If you imagine 30 years from now, and there are scientists who are open to the idea of consciousness being something separate, if I understood your way of talking about it, then is it possible that science could contribute to the helping people become more aware of consciousness? That it has something to contribute to the equation beyond, like, the Buddhist sense of science?
At this point, I would say no, they would not have, because I feel that it's we that do it. It's not the scientists who are going to tell us how to do it. It's we ourselves who become conscious enough, small c conscious enough, and aware of our place in a broader community, and accept the responsibility of doing this, of striving to be aware, striving to improve and add positive things to consciousness, because I think there is a feedback loop. It's us that's going to do it. It's not science. We can't, if we depend on science, then we're going to end. What is science talking about? They're talking about hooking up to computers. We're going to expand our intelligence. That's like chaining a dog to a tree. It's not going to go very far. It's only going to go as far as we are able to make the computers go. And that's it.
Well, I would want to, what came up in me with your question was that it's happening to some extent already in energy, in the field of energy medicine, and all the different experiments that are going on and the different modalities that are being developed.
Right. That's what I was
okay, but would you, what would you call that science?
Yeah.
You would? Okay.
Well, it might not be at the stage that these different modalities are in now. The scientific world might not sanction them, but they will.
Yeah, I think you mentioned Buddhist science. When that Cartesian split comes back together again, and we can accept spirituality as a valid aspect of what we're doing, then yes, then. Then science will do it.
Well, and there are some scientists who are.
Well, yeah, sure, we are some science. But as I said, they were saying it back in the Greeks were saying it, you know, back in 500 BC. It's been said.
Yeah, but we haven't heard it yet.
Yeah, but we haven't heard it. We haven't gone there. There's so many things, you know, that make this dreams, for instance, telepathy, distant healing. The stare response. How many of you turn around to see somebody staring at you, trying to get your attention? You know, it happens all the time. You say something, you know, or you say something. I was just going to say that. You know, what all these are being tied in to the same wavelength, if you will, of consciousness.
The grid or the field.
And the non-locality, for instance, how many times have you thought of somebody and the next phone call is from them? When doesn't that happen? You know? How do you explain that? You know, it's been called synchronicity. You know? It's been called a lot of things.
Excuse me.
There's something important. Pardon?
I've been trying to get your attention.
Oh, I thought you were agreeing with me.
I just would like to know how this relates to the aspect of Carl Jung's collective unconscious, the aspect of where we all have the archetype of spirituality, of seeking the oneness, of seeking God, are they similar?
That's, I'm glad you asked that. I don't have the quote right here, but I quote him several times in the book. His collective unconscious, I think, is what I would call the universal consciousness. I think it's what's available to us all. Okay, and it's the same as Desjardins' New Sphere. It's all of these things together. All right? Okay, so there's so many things that work if we accept this idea, just like the International Geophysical Year. You know, it all came together and it made a lot of sense to think of continental drift. Okay, when you think about this, and there are so many things that become understandable once you accept the idea that we don't generate consciousness, we receive it, we are aware of it. Okay. And I think with that, I think I'm way over time, and I apologize. But one more question.
I've heard it said that children are the best scientists.
Who are?
Children.
Oh.
They're natural scientists.
Yeah.
And I think we can expand our definition, our understanding of science, so that it embraces anything.
And you know why they are? Because they ask questions.
Yes. And and something I wanted to say about increased sensitivity—it's just the word sensitivity—and the role that sensitivity, the evolution of sensitivity, has played in mm-hmm. in the evolution of consciousness, mm-hmm. and the role that our wounding plays in the evolution of our sensitivities, mm-hmm. and the role that wounds play.
And I think you could translate sensitivity in that case to more sensitive awareness. Okay. I'm sorry.
So much to say, so little time.
I apologize for being so late.
Not at all. Thank you.